Welcome to Coffee with Questions, the Sunday morning discussion group at the Tree of Life Unitarian Universalist Congregation in McHenry, Illinois. It's Sunday, August 14th. This morning's discussion, Intellectual Confusion and Clarity, will be facilitated by Russ Marks.
We will discuss Paul Tillich's accepted in his discussion of separation and grace. We will apply his model to human science. The question will be asked, have you experienced separation and grace, intellectual confusion, and clarity? Paul Tillich writes, we cannot transform our lives unless we allow them to be transformed by the stroke of grace. It happens or it does not happen. It happens, for example, when we are in great pain and restlessness. But what causes the great pain and restlessness and the stroke of grace? Tillich and I provide two very different answers to the question. For Tillich, the great pain and restlessness and stroke of grace are a product of the spiritual world. The stroke of grace is a mysterious force that happens or does not happen. Tillich is a sacred theologian. For me, the great pain and restlessness and the stroke of grace are a product of the natural world, a product of unhealthy patterns of thinking and behavior and healthy patterns of thinking and behavior. I am a deist and a human scientist. I asked my sister, are separation and grace part of a product of the spiritual world or natural world? Jeanette wrote, they are both. I wrote, yes, religion creates science, and God we trust creates the American experiment. Paul Tillich's religion is the key to human science, a science of human nature. Science is the scientific method. The scientific method discovers separation and grace. Step one, identify the problem. Where do I experience separation in my life? Step two, gather all of the facts about this separation. Step three, form an hypothesis about how you are going to solve the problem of separation. Step four, test the hypothesis. Step five, experience the results of a successful hypothesis, which is grace. If the hypothesis fails to create another hypothesis and test it. Jeanette writes, change happens in spite of ourselves sometimes. I write, one of the purposes of science is to make change predictable and to create predictable change. Grace is dependent upon changing unhealthy thinking and behavior into healthy thinking and behavior. Separation and grace, for example, are about changing an unhealthy lifestyle into a healthy lifestyle, changing intellectual confusion into clarity, shyness into sociability, profound disappointment into a second chance, imperfection into acceptance, fear into courage, unforgiving into forgiving, low expectations into success, insecurity into security, and not safe into safe. Raise your hands if you think separation and grace are part of the spiritual world.
Well, I don't know. That to me is a false dichotomy. But
well, yeah, I have a lot to say about that.
You'll get a chance. Raise your hands if you think separation and grace are part of the natural world.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's part of the spiritual natural world.
Of course. Yeah. The natural world doesn't even exist without the accompanying spirit.
Yeah. And vice versa. It's your dime. You can keep talking.
Yeah, and that's what I said. That they were both. But I said that religion creates science, which I think you would disagree with.
Well, no, I don't know. I don't know about creates. I don't know. I probably would, but continue.
Okay. Then I read an article Don gave me about Tillich's idea of grace, which made me believe I hadn't read Tillich at all. Yes, I have experienced intellectual confusion, and now I'm seeking clarity about Tillich's idea of grace. Tillich writes, thus the state of our whole life is estrangement from others and ourselves, because we are estranged from the ground of our being, because we are estranged from the origin and aim of our life, and we do not know where we have come from or where we are going. We are separated from the mystery, the depth, and the greatness of our existence. We hear the voice of that depth, but our ears are closed. We feel that something radical, total, and unconditioned is demanded of us, but we rebel against it, try to escape its urgency, and will not accept its promise. The author of the article writes, on the topic of depth, that we find ourselves living on the surface. Human life is deeper than any depth we have seen so far. Most people make it their pattern to avoid exploring the depths of their own lives. Our conversations at parties or even with best friends are shallow. Our religious services are shallow. Our willingness to endure doubt or engage in real questions is shallow. This is what it means to be estranged from the depths.
This is what it means to be estranged from the depths.
Estranged from the depths.
And as for greatness, our self-depreciation is more common than our boastfulness. And most of our boastfulness is a cover of our sense of inadequacy.
Our boastfulness?
Boastfulness.
Yeah, just a little of it.
This is a cover for our sense of inadequacy, deficiency, incompetence, and even worthlessness. The plain truth...
Say that sentence again, please.
Most of our boastfulness is a cover for our sense of inadequacy.
Stop there for just a minute. Because most of our boastfulness is a cover for our sense of inadequacy. Do I hear it straight?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. It made me think of Trump. That's why I wanted you to repeat that.
Yeah, could be.
Trump.
Yes.
Well, I was thinking about
us.
I was thinking about
I don't see you as a boast us, meaning you. I don't see you as a boastful person. I mean, not every boast is comes from an inadequacy, but certainly a personality style like his may.
Well, I'm thinking of myself and the reactions that I've had at this table with Alan and Nelson. I mean, they would say things, well, Nelson's easier to work with because what he says, well, he's easier to work with or work against. But you know, I can, explode the times I've exploded at things Nelson said. And that was boastfulness. You know, you don't know anything. I was a Catholic for a long time. I was in a mental hospital for a long time. You're stupid. That's boastfulness. And it's something I wish I hadn't said. But it was from inadequacy because he was touching on things that I worry about.
Well, I would have thought that what we're hearing from Ross is what Tillich is asserting, not about some person, but about all persons.
Well, I don't know about
our boastfulness. Yeah. Our refers, the way I'm here, tell me if I'm wrong, Ross, but I would understand that what you're reading out there is like an assertion about the human situation, not about certain people that appear to be more boastful than other people.
That was just my thing was just an offside comment, because it was so it evoked his personality. That's why I made that comment.
Yes, but all of us boast in a certain way. For example, I'm boasting right now by making my own assertion at the table. And it's my boast to cover my sense of inadequacy. Am I adequate to enter this conversation? I might feel, oh no, I'm just supposed to lay back.
Can a boast be... When I think of boast, I think that it is something that a person does. can a society or a nation do the same thing? Can it be collective?
Yes, I would think he's certainly using the word our. Mm-hmm. That includes us, but is a reference to beyond me. So certainly what you're saying would certainly be encompassed by the word our.
So in the Olympics, when they shout, USA, yeah, USA, yeah. USA. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Is that a boast?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, and there are degrees and importances of boastfulness, like last night's high school football game or something. The fans were boastful. And I don't know if there's much wrong with that. You know, our team, all the things that were wrong with Michigan City and right with the LaPorte Slicers and wrong with the Michigan City Red Devils when I was in the sixth grade. We were boastful about the Slicers. And I think there's a certain amount of that in USA, USA. But maybe there's something deeper and more serious.
And I would think that what, now again, Russ, I appeal to you as a presenter, I would think that what Tillich is trying to say to us is, in spite of the fact that we discover that all these things, our boastfulness is a cover for our inadequacy and so on, that applies to all people, how do we then reach grace, alias, we're accepted in spite of the fact that all of this is going on, and liberated to at least participate in the world, and not feel like just because my speaking has in it a certain boastfulness, I'm supposed to never speak or never say a word and just sit in a corner somewhere like this.
Well, that's where the virtue of fortitude comes in. We have to be somewhat brave. Well, I think that's where fortitude.
We don't have to be, but how does it occur that somehow or other we are acceptable?
Maybe
the ground of our own being.
Maybe the
in
way.
Spite of these various experiences that we discover represent
maybe
inadequacy,
the way. Maybe the way.
Boastfulness.
Would you shut up and let me talk for a little while?
I'm not stopping
being brought up because sister said, and if you had to refer to somebody else, it was because father said, and that kind of makes me feel bad about my boastfulness. Okay,
well,
continue.
Feeling good about oneself and liking oneself and saying that is not a boastful statement.
So you want to deny the existence of the boastfulness itself as
no,
part of the human
condition?
No,
I'm acknowledging because one feels good, says that they've done something that if they really have done something that is really good, is not boastful. Is not boastfulness. It may be more of acceptance of liking oneself. Boastfulness is more of a grandiose statement of one's
delusion of grandeur.
Yeah.
I'm the second coming of Jesus Christ.
I don't know whether that just
maybe.
If I'm a slug sitting here, I am worthy whether I have done anything or not. I don't have to have done anything to make me worthy. I look at when there's some tragedy like a mass shooting, the people try to assign a motive to it. And so many times it comes back, well, this person was a loner. Do we have, as human beings, an obligation to help people feel good about themselves?
I would say not an obligation, but a wonderful opportunity to experience the depths of love.
Yeah, I would say an opportunity, not necessarily wonderful, but an opportunity. An opportunity.
We certainly have an obligation not to make that person feel bad about themselves.
Okay, that's good. that's the other side of it.
A modesty about whatever I do is what made it happen.
Is what?
I would assert a modesty such that the word make other people this or that is already a misnomer. Like, that's part of my boastfulness, that I'm the one that makes this and makes that.
I'm not following you. Modesty and boastfulness and makes. Say it again in different words.
I'm just asserting a modesty about these kinds of statements, whether it's an obligation or not, and regardless of my motivation, that the notion that I'm the one that makes other people happy or unhappy is like almost an incredible arrogance.
Yeah, like when Nelson...
I don't make everybody happy or unhappy.
Like when Nelson comes in and talks all his bullshit, from my point of view, I don't have an obligation to correct him. I, being modest, I realize I don't have an obligation. I would like to correct him, and I don't correct him by cussing him out. and that's why I try to cultivate modesty.
Let me go on from here.
You're here too, aren't you?
The plain truth is that underneath all our self-deprecation and minimize responsibility, each of us is a very capable and powerful being with amazing potentiality for aliveness, compassion, justice, and so on. But as Tillich says in his conclusion, we rebel against it, try to escape its urgency, and will not accept its promise. Mm-hmm. So there's the other side to that.
There's some one thing, or are you more there?
Yeah, I can go on, or if you want to.
Well, I didn't want to, this is so rich. I mean, almost every sentence you're saying has so much depth and richness in it. You appeared to identify grace with healthy. And even though I raised my hand, on both, is it part of spirit or is it part of nature? I would assert both. But in any case, in spite of that, the dimension that to me I would at least attribute to the religious dimension or the divine dimension is not the same as what is meant by health in the ordinary meaning of that word. For example, if I, like, let's say Martin Luther King, does something, the end result of which results in me getting murdered, doesn't mean that I have betrayed the call to be unified or overcome the separation. The mere health in the ordinary use of that word is not what is referred to, I would assert. There is another kind of health, which is like fulfilling my being existing at all. And that's what this call is all about. Whether it results in me becoming sick or not becoming sick, in the ordinary meaning of the natural meaning of that word, is not the test.
Okay.
I may become sick. I may become like the guy that wrote Pilgrim's Progress, wrote it while he was in jail. Abraham Lincoln was also shot. It wasn't a healthy thing for him to get involved to become the president and do the things that he did, and so on and so on.
Yeah.
Not in the ordinary uses of that word, but yet would not be despised by people who would understand what this is all about. Even people might go into a mental institution, might go there and go through that. You know, Oppenheimer, who was, now you may want to make a different judgment about Oppenheimer, because he was a person who facilitated the development of the atom bomb, which you might regard as ambiguous. But just the same, when you read a great book called, I think a kind of a great book, although I must say I was terrified to read it, called American Prometheus, you discover that in his 20s he not only was a person who was attempting to kill one of his professors, was rescued by his family, was in years of psychiatric therapy, and could be regarded as somebody who went through a disastrous or near disastrous period in his young life, including mental illness, and yet became, to some people's minds, a hero of the scientific world.
Yeah.
Let me continue.
Let
me continue here just a minute. The author writes, the inescapable ground may not always be visible to us, so our despair can remain hidden as well. But Tillich gives us hints as to how the deep trauma comes to the surface. Our feelings of meaninglessness, emptiness, doubt, and cynicism. We ask ourselves which of these we have experienced most. We can inquire into our inner reality to see if what Tillich says is true, that these feelings are rooted in our estrangement from the ground of our being. It's important to note that despair is not a moral issue. It is a sickness, a tragedy, a wasting of our lives, a loss of joy and courage and compassion and personal strength. Despair is a painful sickness so deep that many of us prefer death to even looking despair in the face. Tillich says in no uncertain terms that the happening of grace is not a sudden burst of believing that something is true, and grace is not moral progress, although such progress may result from the happening of grace. Tillich is saying that grace is not an achievement of human doing. It is neither an intellectual achievement nor a behavioral achievement. Tillich is determined to drive home one basic point. Grace is happening. And like all happenings, it either happens or it does not happen. This may offend us because it means that we are not in control. We cannot make it happen. We cannot take credit for the healing of our own lives. We cannot be sure that grace will happen at all. So now Tillich has us ready to hear his answer to the question, what is the happening of grace like? Tillich writes, grace strikes us when we are in great pain and restlessness. It strikes us when we walk the dark valley of a meaningless and empty life. It strikes us when we feel that our separation is deeper than usual because we have violated another life, a life which we love or from which we are estranged. It strikes us when our disgust for our own being, our indifference, our weakness, our hostility, and our lack of direction and composure have become intolerable to us. It strikes us when, year after year, the longed-for perfection of our life does not appear, when the old compulsions reign within us as they have for decades, when despair destroys all joy and courage. The author writes, "These lines are the sort of poetry that can awaken us to some deep experience that we might not want to expose. It might be helpful to pick the sentence among these five with which we most identify and inquire into what exactly it is pointing to in our experience. Why would we do this? Because Tillich is saying that this is the first aspect of the happening of grace. Grace happens to us when the despairing aspects of our living are coming to the surface of our consciousness. These grim feelings may be there always, but grace is not happening until such feelings begin to disappear. The surfacing of our despair means the self-conscious experience of being in despair. The moment in which grace is beginning to happen is the moment in which we are beginning to be willing to be in the despair we are actually despairing."
To be what about despair?
To be in
the moment in which grace is beginning to happen is the moment in which we are beginning to be willing to be in despair.
Willing to be in despair. That's what you talked about last time, right?
Tillich writes, "Sometimes at that moment a wave of light breaks into our darkness. It is as though a voice were saying, 'You are accepted. You are accepted, accepted by that which is greater than you, and the name of which you do not know.'" Tillich writes, "Do not try to do anything now. Perhaps later you will do much. Do not seek for anything. Do not perform anything. Do not intend anything. Simply accept the fact that you are accepted."
Russ, before you continue, I'd like to ask you, you're so familiar with this philosopher. What are your feelings about what he said?
Well, I think it's very difficult to get to the depth that he's talking about. But I think it's essential.
How does it impact you?
Well, it impacts me in the sense that it's something that I believe in. What he's saying is true. It has meaning in my life.
That's what I'm trying to explore. What is he saying that has personally impacted on your life?
Good question. What is he saying to you? Your life.
The reason why I'm asking that is because you've studied him. You appear to admire him. And I'm wondering, how has that philosophy, since you're so familiar with it, I'm not.
Well, I consider myself just a babe in terms of understanding.
But in some way, there must be some impact. You changed your life? Have you tried to do something because of what he's said?
Well, now, you were Tillich's assistant, teaching assistant.
I was.
At one
really?
Time.
Yes. Okay, I give me some of that. That's
I was
that's
the
interesting
assistant
stuff.
To Tillich's assistant.
Yes.
Okay, but that's you were at the same university?
I was Harvard.
Okay, at the same time?
Tillich was the theology professor at Harvard Divinity School.
Okay, and you were there at the same time?
Yes.
In the philosophy department?
No. In fact, your use of the word philosophy is not acceptable to me.
Okay, I'm sorry, then that was ignorance. What is he considered? What department does he fall into?
You know, the word department even is like hidden inside of everything I heard from Russ. The primary distinction he's trying to make here is between separation and being with. And the word department is one of those words that is part of the mentality of our times, to separate.
Yes, but in Harvard, there are departments.
Yes.
Which one did he belong to? Which one did pay his salary?
I'm very reluctant to answer the question for the reason that I just spoke. I could name, quote, a department, but Tillich actually, when Tillich lectured, the room was full of students not from his department.
Okay, but you did mention the word department. So what department?
I use the word because it's one of those words that's out there, just like Tillich is using words
just
too,
tell
like
me,
despair.
Was he in psychology, physics, chemistry? What department?
It almost seems like you wouldn't want to step outside of a world of separation.
I can't answer that.
I can't answer your questions because it would be like saying department is an okay way to stick this person.
No.
Let's see. Did I understand you to ask Judy?
I asked Russ a personal question.
How?
Well, he's given him some personal
answers.
What
has he done to change or...
How is he impacted?
And my understanding is that you don't do anything. It just, all of a sudden it's there.
And you acknowledge it, maybe, is the most that occurs. You have the capacity to acknowledge this, not to say, I did it.
And if you were a child molester, you can still go on and be a child molester.
I don't know what I don't know what you mean by saying something like that. That would be, why would that occur for you as an appropriate kind of response to this? It's very, very strange to me.
It seems like the obvious one to me, so it's two against one.
If
it would have, what would it have? The way I heard Russ speak was, the most thing that you are to do when you are aware of this happening is nothing. Nothing. That's what I just heard him read.
Yeah.
Your response is to do nothing.
Is that the, I thought you were talking about despair.
It doesn't create you to become now a monster or something.
But does it mean okay, let's go to the extreme, child molester. Can a child molester, can Hitler experience grace?
Well, is it for me to say what God could do or not do?
So, possibly one of these people could experience grace. We don't know.
I would certainly say I don't know. But if I couldn't say I don't know, I would be embarrassed.
And as human beings, we make judgments.
Of course we make judgments. There's nothing to say. I didn't hear anything in what Russ read that didn't say, as human beings, we make judgments. That's a part of our everyday awareness.
And our judgment, our judgments, to most of us, our judgments come out of a great deal of baggage.
Yeah, I'm glad you're aware of that, because there's no doubt. And that's also encompassed inside of things that I heard Russ reading, carry a lot of baggage, yes, and therefore limit our freedom.
Yeah, I agree.
And our judgments are not in the category of the joining with the ground of being. They are not in that category. Not like we don't do it. Of course we do it.
What I am attempting to do.
Seeing that we do it, do we go into despair?
Yes. Well, what I'm attempting to do, Tillich speaking on a very intellectual level.
If that's all it is, as he himself says, it's clearly not what he's talking about.
But for the average moron like myself, does it have to be, can it be, the topic today is intellectual confusion and clarity.
Right.
Can somehow it be clarified? Look, guy, this is what you do in everyday life. It isn't just something on the pages of a book.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're discussing here. Is it just something in the pages of a book so we can collectively and very nicely put it in a category and walk away and forget it?
Yeah.
Or does it have something that represents a depth that every human being comes in touch with? And that you might, after you become aware of that, begin to get that it's not just an intellectual confusion.
Does anybody in the group, if it's not Russ, is there anybody that wants to speak to how this philosophy speaks to them on a daily basis today? How it impacts them?
Well, I'll give you an example from my own life.
Okay.
Last night, I tuned into Amazon Prime to see if there was something to watch before going to sleep or bed. And I stumbled on something that turned out to be an absolutely incredibly psychotic producing horror thing. I went forward with it to see what the heck is going to come out of this, and I found out what was going to come out of it. On the one hand was a bag full of movie tricks, and the other part of it was to challenge my capacity to remain sane while I watched it, and I decided to turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to bed wondering whether I was going to be obsessed all night with a sense of losing control of my life because of this idiocy, or whether I would be able, through what he would call the grace of God or some capacity given to me by whatever source, the mystery that some people call God, which is our language here that I like a lot, as I've said many times, would enable me to wake up in the morning and be tend to the life as though it had some value instead of being obsessed with this crapology. Yes, that's where I encountered it literally, and I got out of bed this morning and the first thing I thought about was that damn movie.
I'll just continue then. Tillich says four things not to do and only one thing to do. Why are we asked not to try or seek or perform or intend anything? Because all these seemingly useful responses are just ways of avoiding the real issue. We do not have any need to accomplish some sort of acceptability. We are accepted in spite of any and all unacceptabilities. Even though our life has been a waste, has come to no good, and is now wallowing in the ruin, we are welcome home to reality, as if we were a newborn babe. A newborn babe does not have to do something to justify its welcome. Birth is a sheer gift, which has only to be accepted and then lived. So also this welcome home to reality is a sheer gift that has only to be accepted. But acceptance is an action. It is an action of non-doing. It is the action of doing nothing. Our home is the land of mystery, awe, trust, love, and freedom. It does not have to be built. It was built before we were born, but this one thing does need to be done. Simply accept the fact that you are accepted home. If that happens to us, we experience grace. What happens to us? Let us review. We have
become aware of our particular brand of immobilizing despair. 2, at that moment a dawning takes place, the dawning that we are accepted by that which is greater than we. 3, we have accepted our acceptance. That's it. These three dynamics are what Tillich means by grace, the grace happening, the happening that is grace. So what comes next? Tillich writes, after such an experience, we may not be better than before and may not believe more than before, but everything is transformed. In that moment, grace conquers sin and reconciliation bridges the gulf of estrangement. And nothing is demanded of this experience, no religious or moral or intellectual presupposition, nothing but acceptance. This relationship with the ground of our being is solitary, personal, very much my own or your own relationship. It is also true that grace opens up our membership in a community of people who know grace and live from its foundations. And this community becomes a means of grace to others and to ourselves. This community assists people in discerning and confessing their despair and hearing the cosmic word of their acceptance. Finally, this community beckons people to step out of their delusionary safe boats and walk on the wild waters of accepting the fact that they are accepted. Personally, I long for such a community. I now hope to find such a community by joining the Tree of Life Unitarian Universalist Congregation.
So that's the solution to the whole problem.
And that's the commercial this week, folks.
No.
But Bob, based on what he just read, based on what he just read, the example I used, to which you took exception, of being a child molester, if you could experience grace and still be a child molester.
Forgive me. Off track. I was so impressed by Judy coming in here and bringing me after I put her down in such a way. I received that as an act of grace.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Judy.
For getting the coffee?
Yes, getting the coffee was, for me, an act of grace.
I didn't bring you a cup because I couldn't carry it. Well, who else wants coffee? I
appreciate it.
Would you like a cup of coffee?
No, thanks.
Would you like a cup of coffee?
Yes, I would like a teeny bit.
Okay, I have to get you a cup. Here, take this. I'll get mine. What about you, Don?
No, not for me.
Okay.
So there are three people drinking coffee. We have three cups.
No, that's I got tea in that one.
Oh.
I need another cup.
This is not for me, not for Ross.
For me.
That's all we need.
So Judy coming in with the coffee was... gave you grace, gave Bob grace. Right?
I saw it as an act, I experienced it as an act of grace that she would, after I'm vigorously telling her I can't even accept words she's using.
Well, when she went out, that's kind of what I thought. I thought she was going out.
I thought maybe she was.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to be subjected to this baloney from Bob.
And I was pleasantly surprised when she came back in. Where are we going with this? One of them is it's hard to know what other people are thinking. Or it's impossible to know what other people are thinking. That's part of it. And then is it grace? Well, it's grace if you want to make it grace.
You can't make grace.
If you want to interpret it as grace, it's a gift.
But maybe you can see it that way, even though it isn't thing like it's some kind of supposedly objective. But the word objective and subjective is one of those disjuncts that represents separation.
Let me just go back to this one thing that Tillich says, because I have trouble relating to it, but see what you think. Grace strikes us when we are in great pain and restlessness. Is this true for you?
Yes.
Okay. I would go back to well, a physics teacher I had one time, he was in the physics department, by the way, and we were talking about some physics problem, and he got to talking, about feelings. Actually, we might translate it into he got to talking about grace, and he talked about the sine wave of human existence. The sine wave is a equal wave that goes. Does anybody not know what a sine wave is?
It's the normal curve.
It's a particular kind of a, it goes up a certain distance and down a certain distance, and it's very regular, and except for the shaking, I guess that's a sine wave. It goes up, you take a level, and your feelings go up for a few days, and then down for a few days, and then you hit a bottom, start to go up.
That sounds pretty typical. Okay.
Excuse me
a minute, Bob. let's go back to the question now. Grace strikes us when we are in great pain and restlessness.
Well,
is this true or not?
I don't know about great pain, but how about not so great pain? When we hit the bottom here, we start going up again. When we hit the top here, we start going down again as far as our feelings are concerned.
Yeah.
So is grace, once you have experienced grace, do you have it all the time, or is it something that comes and goes, depending on how you feel?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I would assert that my understanding would be that and following Tillich's language, the experience of grace transforms you. Thus, when you use the term you as though it's the same you before and after, you're not speaking to this kind of experience. It's no longer the same person. You're no longer the same person.
What about this? There's
no such a thing as do you have it or don't have it. You're a changed person.
But I guess the question is, is the change permanent or is it momentary?
Well, I guess he would be implying that it's.
But that's not how. But
that's.
But Bob is saying. But Bob is saying that's not how we feel.
It's not how I feel.
Yes. I'm using. Yes. But Bob, I'm accepting what you say. That is true for me as well.
Okay. And where's that put us?
So that's momentary.
Yeah, the feeling.
It's up and down.
Yeah. Transforming thing, perhaps similar to what some people experience as adolescents, knowing that they're saved or forming a personal relationship with Jesus. Would that be some kind of interpretation of what you're saying?
I don't know. For me to talk about other people, it's really not where it's at.
But you feel that you've been, you feel that you've been permanently changed by something.
Not only once, but many times.
Also,
there's another thing about this.
In order to go up, you have to go down.
Well, I don't, but you're assuming
you
the same
you. Higher and higher.
But I've already responded to that by saying that when you're transformed, you're no longer the same you.
Okay.
So when I go up, I don't have to. It's not the same me that goes down.
All right. Okay.
There's a transformed me that has ups and downs. But by the way, there's something else that I'd just like to put in here. Coming out of last night's experience, if I start, there's two ways I can experience something. One is I experience it. And the other way is I start to look at the experience and make a judgment about it. Now, when I start to look at the experience and make a judgment about it, I know that that experience is now in control of me. Now I'm obsessed with it, as though it's already lurking there and is controlling my thinking. And I immediately go to a place which I experience as a form of meditation. Just go back to being, Bob. Forget this thinking about the feeling. It's not like lecturing myself, though. It's just like,
yes.
I better move.
Can I interrupt for one quick second? Just a quickie question. Is the craft that's in there regular coffee?
Yes, it is.
Because I've got the decaf. Yes. Okay, I just wanted to know what we
and
had
and
what
to make. And I just
shut
it off.
Sorry. Okay, thank you.
Let's go on.
I just want to say that when I start that path, I will immediately, as fast as I can stop it, it's like getting out of the way of a speeding car. As soon as I see myself looking at that feeling and evaluating it, I get out of the way fast. Because it's, and now I know it's about to control me, and this whole day I'm in danger of going into a suicidal depression, like, instantly.
No, well, I've been...
You better get out of the way fast, like a speeding car was about to crash on you.
Okay, we are different. I think I've had several suicidal depressions, but I went into them gradually, and I came out of them gradually.
Well, now, I use the word suicidal depression, but that's ambiguous, isn't it? Because if I had a truly suicidal depression, I would be dead.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that I am not dead means it was not suicidal.
Well,
nevertheless, I'm backing
lucky.
Off of it.
I didn't
fast.
Have a gun.
If you have
and
suicidal,
you don't
have to complete the act in order to feel suicidal.
Oh, you can feel suicidal, but that's different from suicidal because suicidal means you've actually decided.
Bob, I think you get hung up frequently with semantics.
You think words have no meaning? What are
I
you
do
doing
think
here?
Words have meaning, but you piece them together like they were.
Well, getting back to my attempted suicides.
Yes.
Let's see. I told you and Nelson had a great time laughing at one of them that I kept telling you about, where I thought the guy was going to castrate me and I wanted to grab his knife and kill myself.
I never laughed about that, Bob.
Well, you disagreed with it. Whatever. Okay, let's reveal this to people. The first time I went voluntarily to the state mental hospital, I was having my physical, and there were these one little old guy and one big young guy who were giving me a physical, and the young guy was coming up to examine me for a hernia, and I became absolutely sure that he was going to castrate me.
Okay.
And I was also, and the old guy with the white coat had his hand in his pocket all the time. I was absolutely sure that he had a gun in his pocket. And so I'm gonna dive for the old guy to get his gun. And I said, I just wanna use it on myself. I just wanna use it on myself. Mm-hmm. Well, that was one of my attempts at suicide. And what am I saying here, except that I'm a exceptional and remarkable guy. I don't know. Okay. Now, so you're saying I was not suicidal because I didn't succeed?
No, of course. If I say I'm suicidal and then I don't commit suicide, how is I suicidal? I had suicidal thoughts.
I agree with her. You're putting too much attention on words.
Well, I think of being able to distinguish between actually committing suicide and not doing so is not just fiddling with words.
But saying it's pertinent to suicide is fiddling with words.
Well, I don't consider it mere fiddling with words. I can tell you from the bottom of my heart.
If he had a gun, I would have killed myself. I don't know if I would have killed myself. But it might have been different.
There's a lot of ways to interpret. I did laugh when you told that story, but not because of what you said, but because of what Nelson said.
Well, I think he laughed and then you laughed.
What
did Nelson say?
He said, because you challenged him, you were saying to Nelson, when Nelson denied these things as mental illness.
Oh, there's no such thing as mental illness.
He said, I'm telling you that what you call mental illness is a myth.
Yeah.
And then you said this story, and you said to Nelson, if you call that, how could you call that a myth?
And I think I said, and
if this is not psychotic, what do you call it? And Nelson said, I call it a mistaken judgment.
I remember that now.
And I laughed, and I continue to laugh.
Well,
and
I
there
cussed.
Are many ways to interpret your story.
I cussed, and I continue to cuss. I took that quite personally.
Well, you think it's a put down, but I think it's a put up.
So last night I was talking to a friend, and I was saying, this organization wants me to do something. I'm not going to do it. Fuck them. And the friend said, why are you so angry?
Yes.
And I said, I don't use that term in anger. I use that term to mean whatever they... I don't care what they want. And that's what it means to me. It's not that I'm angry. I've made up my mind. This is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. Now, did that come out of a feeling of grace?
Grace is not a feeling. It's an event.
Did that come out of the event of grace?
It might very well have. That you're free enough to say things that other people might despise you for and not get upset about it. You just want to assert your way of being in the presence of other people. And that's a perfectly plausible interpretation.
And I don't know whether it came out of grace or not, but I have accepted this is what I'm going to do, and this is what I'm going to do.
And you're not being controlled by other people's manipulations of you. I would say, as far as I understand it, you know, Tillich's great book was called, or his best known book anyway, was called The Courage to Be.
And it's three volumes?
No, that's his systematic theology. This is a book, his biggest selling book, and so on.
Okay.
The Courage to Be, which is not the same as the courage to act. It's not the same as the, whatever, the courage to kill and be killed in war or whatever. The courage to be, in spite of all of the ambiguities and issues and problems and judgments and so on, all those things that would tempt me into despair. I could get hurt if I did this, or I could hurt somebody else even though I don't intend to. Maybe I would be wrong and I can't bear being wrong because I'm told that I should be right. On and on and on and on, all the reasons to deny my own authenticity and decency as a person.
And perhaps an absence of fear?
I don't know about the absence of fear, but the absence of fear controlling me.
Yes.
Because fear has a positive aspect to it. If you are standing in the middle of a road and a car's rushing at you and you don't feel fear, you're in trouble. Fear
perhaps
is a gift.
Perhaps you're suicidal.
It could be suicidal, except suicide really supposes you know what you're doing. But somebody that does this, what the heck is going on? They must be deranged.
Was Jesus suicidal?
Jesus is sometimes seen. There's a whole literature about Jesus as a suicide. There's a whole literature about St. Paul as a psychotic. It was very popular in the late 19th century.
Now, how do you define psychotic?
I'm sorry?
How do you define psychotic?
Well, obviously, that's one of the words that Judy would accuse me of being niggling over. It's got a thousand different possible meanings, of course.
Well, give me the one you were using. You said something was psychotic. What do you mean by that in different
words?
Well,
in my own, if I'm speaking in my own person, I'm kind of in Nelson's camp. I don't think it's a serious word. It's a word that is being used because of certain cultural things that have happened over the last several centuries. There was no such a word until about 200 years ago. And so there were all kinds of behaviors, but they weren't called by these labels.
Being possessed by a devil was a common interpretation.
No, but this notion, as Nelson would call it, gained popularity, then people love to throw it around. And a lot of people are supposedly crazy and or psychotic, if we're going to be more elegant and elitist about it. We're going to call it by these Greco-Roman words, because that gives them a lot of prestige.
Well, that was a very big and unpleasant experience in my life, and I get the feeling you're just playing with it. You're not taking it seriously.
I think it was indeed a very important experience in your life. I am not taking it seriously, but I think it represents a certain amount of courage on your part and a certain amount of self-understanding.
Well, thank you.
And you knew that you were going through some deep and difficult experiences. You were not stupid enough to pretend you weren't. That would be my sense of it.
I've heard it, that a person is psychotic if he does not have a conventional view of reality.
I would say a person who has a conventional view of reality is probably a non-person. Because such a person is controlled by some mere stereotypes.
But let me give you the example he gave. You know, you lived in a culture where we lived on the back of a big turtle who lives on the back of another big turtle and so forth.
Turtle?
This is an example that somebody gave.
Native American spiritual.
Well, I don't want to blame it on Native Americans, but it's a tribe that they lived out in the jungle and they never met anybody else. And he'd always been told that this world was a big turtle on the back of another big turtle.
Okay.
That would be a conventional view of reality. And I was just sure of that, like 2 and 2 is 4, or he was just sure of that. If you or I believed that, that would not be a conventional.
Right.
Or we're sure of that. Mm-hmm. We're convinced of that. I don't want to use the word believe. We're sure of that. We're convinced of that. Why we would not have a conventional view of reality, and I would say that I was psychotic, or if that person, well, mm-hmm. I'll shut up.
Yeah,
is what I mean by psychotic.
Well, I would say in defense of my own view of you, Bob. But it's up to you, of course, to decide for yourself. But my own view of you is that those, in a moment, you could decide that those experiences were the result of the grace of God. You were transformed. You made an absolutely major shift in your life over intending, being trained, living inside of a world of a certain type of belief system, which you interpreted in such a way that you could not, in proper integrity, accept it. And you went through the dark night of the soul and came out another person. That is a respectable life transformation that deserves to be respected and not put into a category that isolates you in any way whatsoever but gives you the power of understanding that many people don't have.
Okay.
That would be my interpretation.
First, thank you. But I think it gave me an experience that allowed me to help other people who have mental problems.
Well, that's perfectly fine.
And I have discovered the commercial, Dr. Abraham Lowe's recovery method. The second time I was hospitalized with paranoid delusions, and I got out, my psychiatrist said, how'd you let, what do you think of a group? And I said, I'm not going to tell people what I did. and he said, you don't have to. And then I got connected with Dr. Abraham Lowe's recovery method, which I've been practicing more or less for about 47 years, and life's been a lot more enjoyable. Where am I going with this? Before that, now that was one instance, the one that was least hard to talk about. I'd had a similar instance about 3 days before that, and I had a similar experience the next day, which are also difficult for me to talk about, and I'm used to talking about the one I talked about. So I had this life-changing, wonderful experience 3 times in 10 days.
Well, so you went through steps, and you learned a lot, and
yes,
you've helped
I
other people out of the learnings. What am I supposed to take out of that? The what take I have is, you could in a moment decide that every single one of those steps was the result of the grace of God.
Okay. I'm not arguing with you. I'm arguing with people who say when I was 17 years old, I had this experience of being saved, and I'm not going to think about it anymore. I think I thought that's what you were saying.
No,
that was your interpretation of some people's interpretation of grace.
I would have to be talking to an actual person, not some fantasy in my mind and a fantasy in your mind. I have talked to many fundamentalists. I would never forget being down in Grant Park, and a couple of young people approached me whether I was saved, as Jesus Christ was my personal savior, and so on and so on. I had a wonderful talk with those young people. Thank you, young people, for doing that instead of being out there slashing tires or shooting people in the streets.
Okay, I've had that experience, and other people have too. But what? Okay, when I talk to those young people, without going into the details, I say, particularly the Mormon kids, had one summer, several visits with a couple of Mormon guys, and I talked to them. And my message to them was, without going into all the detail I've gone into, I used to be a lot like you guys, and then I changed my mind about it. So if you ever change your mind about it, why don't worry about it too much, because people change their mind about these things. So that's part of my message for mental illness and also for religion.
Well, I would concur with that also. I don't feel very far away from you, Bob.
Well, that's why we argue so much. Close.
Sure, arguing itself is a gift from God.
That's something else of my undefended beliefs. The only two important things that are worth talking about are religion and politics.
And sex. Those are the three that are not supposed to talk about in the late company.
All right, sex is fine. Okay, I could ask.
We could continue with this next week, or if you want to go to another topic.
Well, I don't find any meaning of just reading from his philosophy if we're not going to bring it to the table and talk about how it affects you or me personally.
I'd like to make an observation about what Russ is doing, not like it's right or wrong, but when you asked him the question, what do you feel has been the result in your life? If I were Russ, I might have said, it gives me the feeling of joy to be able to share what I'm reading with you at this table.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's not, but is it the philosophy that's bringing joy, or is it just sharing something that he's interested in bringing joy?
Well, talking is a form of sharing.
Yeah, but I'm trying to get a little bit more personal about it.
I love it that you're willing to logic chop very carefully around the things that I felt like you were like accusing me of, and you are doing this in a very helpful manner.
I'm not accusing anyone. I'm trying to switch, take the philosophy that obviously is very important to Russ, and try to bring it down to a level where I can understand why it's meaningful to you and you and you and me.
And I would like to ask you a question out of the way you just said that. Why did you say bring it down? Why didn't you say bring it up?
Semantics, or maybe not.
No,
I don't know.
You got something there.
Is that usual, the way it's done? I mean, is it? You may be right. It may be up.
Well, the common phraseology is you bring something intellectual down.
That's what I thought. I was just using the word.
Ordinary folk. To where folk who don't have such an ability to understand intellectual things.
Yeah. Well, and strange to say, people do understand the difference between up and down. And that is one of those intellectual
Well,
things.
In my case, it is truly down.
No.
And it's really,
no.
It's really not a case of that the common so-called people are being down from this up.
Okay. I have
really
sat in philosophy class.
One of the problems that the
I sat in philosophy class and memorized stuff and regurgitated.
And it hasn't been very helpful to me.
Look down on Trump's base.
I'm sorry?
The elite in this country look down on Trump's base.
And well, Trump himself, you know, here's an insight on Trump, which I'm wondering if I could put out somewhere somehow.
Sure.
He has a remarkable resemblance to the movement in when the Marxist philosophy, if you want to call it a philosophy, when the Marxist posture got transformed by Lenin and Stalin into the dictatorship of the proletariat. Instead of the workers' councils being in charge of the country, it was going to be the dictatorship of the proletariat. There was going to be somebody, because the proletariat were too dumb, they were too down, they were not elitist enough, and some elite person had to become the dictator in order to teach them and order them what to say and think.
But of course, the dictatorship was only temporary.
Whatever. But remarkably is almost at the look of where Trump is.
Yeah, I think that's a great insight.
In spite of him being a supposed person from the Republicans, look how the Republicans are discovering that they are not in tune with this guy, because he represents whatever I think is what you should go with.
Yeah.
And doesn't want those people from the so-called down to participate in what's going to happen.
Is that only true of Trump, or is that true of the elite? in this country in general?
You will have to decide that for yourself, because there could be more than one form of elite. And the elite could be the down group inside of some certain ideologies, as though the elite are supposed to be down instead of up, and not worthy of respect, but only to be put in a category so that they can be ignored.
Yeah, what's this thing that happened in China in the last days of Chairman Mao? He took all the elites and sent them out in the countryside to be farmers because they were getting to be too elite.
I don't know, because
well, I was trying to
show the cultural revolution.
The Cultural Revolution, exactly. They all started out together in pure communism, we might say pure Marxism, and then he felt that they were developing an elite, and so because they were up. And so he decided to bring them down.
Well, I think that the term elite, like many, many terms, is ambiguous. The so-called elite, if you look inside of the intention of those people, what they were trying to do was to deny the authority of the elite from the past and replace them with an elite that was going to be effectively in power of the present and the future.
Like your friend Plato, the rulers should all be philosophers.
Well, I don't know, because the word philosophy now means somebody who's irrelevant.
A little bit of this.
Whereas for Plato, it meant somebody that loved learning. Well, it doesn't mean that today. Today it means somebody who's irrelevant.
Thank you.
Well, I think some people would say people who love learning are irrelevant. I mean, they're just obvious things, we don't have to learn them.
Well, I don't know, but there's going to be different types of love learning, too. There's going to be the love of learning for the past so that I can be part of the establishment and control other people, or there could be another kind of elite that stands for the possibility of a future. They both love learning, but they don't love the same learning or for the same purpose.
Yeah.
So the mere use of the word elite is not a very useful term. I remember when I interviewed Paul Simon before he died, he was one of my colleagues across the hall when I was at Sangamon State, and I visited him in Congress and I said, tell me something about the liberal point of view on this or that, and he said, I will not answer your question. He said, if you use the word liberal or the word conservative, I will not answer your question. Okay. Because those words are too wide, too big. Please ask me about specific positions.
I think we got off the topic that Don just brought up.
What do you think is the topic?
Don?
Did I bring up a topic?
I'm leaving.
Okay.
You're getting to be too powerful. You can't.
It's
you 22. Can't turn and face it.
I like to. Well,
it
okay.
is our time.
Next week. Do you want to talk, or do you want to talk?